Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here. Mike
Cosentino way over here.
Is sitting over there in the distance, and we've got our funny-looking headphones on today. And the reason we have them on is we have a caller named Juan Cole, brilliant fellow. He's Richard P. Mitchell, Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan, Director of the Center for South Asian Studies. He's written dozens of scholarly articles and several books on both on Egyptian history and current politics on in the Arab world. In 2002, he started a blog called Informed Comment, which has been sort of a center for people who are interested in independent ideas about the Middle East, non-hysterical information, opinion analysis from someone who actually speaks the languages of the Middle East and has spent a good deal of time there. And so sometime after 9/11, and I think in 2004, I found his blog on the internet, and I've been reading it on and off ever since. And so Juan Cole started blogging regularly when it wasn't really academically respectable, Mike. I mean, the first thing you do is you start blogging a lot, they're going to accuse you of not doing good academic work.
It's still a fringe activity.
It's still a fringe activity. Now it's much more accepted, but he has one of the strongest, most interesting blogs on the internet, and a place where everybody, or at least a lot of people interested in these issues, have gone for a long time. Good morning, Juan. How are you doing?
Just fine, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
We wanted to talk about Egypt today, and you know, our program tend to focus on domestic issues, and one of the issues we've been following for the last 2 years is Arab Spring and its many different unfoldings. Egypt is in the headlines today, right, Mike?
Yeah, we thought we were done with Egypt. You know, here in the West, we thought Egypt had succeeded and accomplished its goal, or at least it was moving toward it, and then with the election, with quite frankly, of the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, it seems to have gone the other way. And so what can we do here? We're talking about, at least I'm looking at an article in Foreign Policy magazine by Charles Holmes, and he says it's a slow motion collapse of the last 60 years of Mubarak. And of Nasser before him, that this is Mubarak continued Nasser's policies, and Egyptians were apparently content to let that happen, and then along comes Arab Spring. 2 years ago, we have the anniversary last week. Tell us what's going on.
Well, the Egyptian people overthrew their long-serving dictator Hosni Mubarak 2 years ago, or they began overthrowing him 2 years ago. February 14th will be the anniversary. And the Mubarak regime, was kind of East Bloc light. It originated in a military coup. It moved towards a kind of socialism, an enormous state sector. About 50% of the people work for the government. And it was state-led industrialization. The entrepreneurs hadn't founded much industry in Egypt, so the state did it, expanded education. I suppose conservatives would call it a nanny state. It took care of people.
Well, yeah, I saw something about 25% of the budget by the 1970s, anyway, was toward education, given toward education. Now it's minuscule. And
I think the other thing that people like us who have an informal interest in international affairs for a very long time, we watch the Arab world and we watch things change, the dictatorships break up in South America, Central America to a degree, and until Arab Spring, nothing seemed to be happening, and then suddenly it exploded. It starts in Tunisia, starts with a fruit vendor who's getting robbed, and then it spreads to Egypt. And we have these, you know, these magnificent and sort of inspiring demonstrations in a major square in Cairo, and everything seems possible. And then we have the elections.
Yeah, well, the people wanted to move to a parliamentary government. I think this young generation of Arabs views the kind of politics that happens in France and Germany and in the UK and the United States as normal politics.
I see.
And that's what they didn't have. They had a police state. So one of their demands has been for free and fair, transparent elections. And one of the contradictions here is that the young people who made the revolution were mostly left of center, pro-labor, relatively secular-minded. But if you move those countries towards a parliamentary regime, if you have free and fair open elections, then it's the religious right that would win the elections. It's the Egyptian Tea Party that would come to power. And so there's a profound contradiction between the procedural aspirations of the people for parliamentary rule and the actual situation in a place like Egypt, where it's likely that the religious right would win every election for a while.
Good point. That's, you know, one of the criticisms of Obama is that he, you know, doesn't encourage democracy enough. But it's not, as you just pointed out, that simple. By encouraging democracy, you're just encouraging a more repressive conservative regime.
Well, in some countries, it's released all kinds of secular violence. In Egypt, which you've got, I think, about 82 million people, it's almost all Sunni Muslim and I think about 10% Christian, something like that. So you haven't had the sectarian violence in Syria. But when the collapse of the military control, the Muslim Brotherhood, which was the strongest opposition group, sort of took over. And what's your take on the new leadership? Is it really separate? And we have had people before who were skeptical that the Egyptian military were going to keep running Egypt no matter who was the elected president and stuff. What's happening in that regard?
Well, Mohamed Morsi won the presidential election last June. He is from the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood is itself a kind of sectarian institution. You have to pledge fealty to its leader and so forth, but it spun off a civil political wing, the Freedom and Justice Party, and it says that party, you know, has no line to God. It's fallible, and it will contest elections. If it loses, it'll go home. So it wants to play the parliamentary game. And so Morsi won the presidency, and there will be parliamentary elections later this year. They're hoping to dominate those as well, the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think Morsi has, in fact, somewhat subordinated the military. Worked with more junior generals who were tired of the old guys and moved some of them out. And so since August, we really haven't seen an intervention by the military in Egyptian politics. It's been Morsi, who often has overreached, has claimed prerogatives, and who seems to think he's still in danger of having a coup made against him by the old Mubarak elites, who are still there and still very powerful and still dominating the judiciary and the bureaucracy.
I mean, get the sense that the only opposition is Mubarak. The only Morsi takes over as Muslim Brotherhood president, and has made some reforms. At least he cleans up the military a little bit, and but the military's budget is still secret, and nobody knows how much money he's spending and all that. Look, so there's further to go in the military, I believe. But is there any opposition to Morsi now, and is there any opposition that will help form the parliament to be a check and balance on this president?
Well, Well, there could be. I mean, there are opposition parties, and Morsi really barely won the presidency. He had strong opposition. I was in Egypt last May when they had the first round of the presidential elections. They do it like in France. You have a first round that winnows it down to two, and then you have a runoff. And actually, in that first round, there were five strong candidates. Three of them were secular. One of them was an out-and-out leftist, kind of a throwback to the old Abdel Nasser days. And the labor unions came out for him, and he won Alexandria. The other two secularists were had broken with Mubarak. There was a liberal Muslim. Morsi was only one of five, and he happened to get into the runoff. But the worst possible thing happened. One of the old Mubarak guys, Ahmed Shafiq, who was Mubarak's last prime minister, and admitted faults in the old man, but, you know, wasn't really very much against him. He came out almost equal with Morsi, and so it was a runoff between a Mubarak clone and the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's not what the young people who made the revolution, that's not the kind of choice that they were hoping for.
Right.
So Morsi won. People held their nose and said, well, we don't want a Mubarak clone again. So they voted for the Muslim Brotherhood, but barely. So, yeah, I mean, there are lots of opposition parties. There are left labor parties. There are liberal parties. There are liberal Muslim parties who think that Morsi is too hardline. But it's the Brotherhood that has been the main opposition, as you said, through the Mubarak years, and which has experience in canvassing and getting out a vote, because they contested the phony elections the Mubarak used to have. And they were willing to, take their hits, and if they could get 17 members in a 400-member assembly in, they would do that. And they just developed, an ability to walk neighborhoods and contact people and get the vote out, because they've been doing that for 30 years. And nobody else really has that experience. So the left labor, the young people, the enthusiasts who made the revolution, and the older liberals, those guys, you know, they have small parties, they're not very well organized, and you can't tell what's going to happen, but when they go to parliamentary elections, it seems likely that the religious right will again dominate parliament, and Morsi won't, in fact, have a strong check on him from that direction, although he doesn't control the judiciary, and the military is still a wild card.
Now, probably confusing a lot of American, what is the recent rioting about? Some of it's connected with a soccer game that occurred in Alexandria, and I think that, you know, Americans tend to look down on people who have soccer riots and stuff, but there's more to it, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I live in Ann Arbor, and we have football riots from time to time.
Yeah. Those are okay.
I'm from Oklahoma, and the Oklahoma-Texas game.
Basketball riot, too. Yeah. Anyway, it was in Port Said last year. What happened is very interesting. The soccer fans, some of them soccer hoodlums, were an important part of the revolution. They provided kind of the bodyguards for the crowds at Tahrir Square. And, you know, since they're soccer hoodlums, they're into rowdy behavior, and they have a long-running feud with the secret police. So they were very happy about the revolution in Cairo. But in Port Said, the soccer hoodlums were kind of aligned with the regime. And so there was this match in last February where there was a disturbance, and the Port Said soccer hoodlums came out onto into the arena and caused a stampede, and 72 people were killed in that stampede, and it was rowdiness of a sort that made people think, well, maybe those soccer hoodlums and elements of the old regime are taking revenge, because the team that was playing against Port Said was Al Ahli, which was the fans of Al Ahli were the ones who helped make the revolution. So it was pro Mubarak and anti Mubarak soccer hoodlums. And the court looked into it, and they sentenced 21 soccer hoodlums to death on Saturday in Port Said for having instigated the stampede. And they seem to have bought the story that these guys were, you know, hand in hand with the secret police, and it was an anti-Ahli strike. Well, of course, the people in Port Said were very upset by this verdict, and it was a very harsh verdict, and so the city erupted into violence, and so the military has come in, and Morsi has declared martial law, emergency law, in three major cities along the Suez Canal, where there had been disturbances. But the soccer disturbances are secondary to the general disturbances of people who were commemorating the two-year anniversary of the revolution and who are unhappy with how things have turned out so far.
So is a declaration of martial law a reasonable thing? I mean, it's being seen as a step backward. Now, here's Mubarak again declaring an emergency so he can be brutal. But I think you're making it sound like, and I'm willing to go with what you say here, that martial law, or at least the emergency situation in the three cities that he's done it in, is actually a reasonable life-saving thing, or not?
Well, it's hard to know the situation on the ground in these places. That's there true. Have been a lot of reports of government offices attacked, of vandalism, of deaths and clashes with the police, whether it rises to the point where you need emergency laws and the suspension of civil liberties is a big issue. I think it's difficult for Morsi to make this move because the whole of Egypt had been under emergency laws since 1981, and it was one of the demands of the revolution that they be lifted, that civil liberties be restored. And Morsi had said that emergency laws are always dictatorial back when he was in the opposition. So now he's president, and he's deploying them. He did say that there is a curfew for 30 days, and it's a public security measure. But a lot of Egyptians are afraid that, you know, you start with three cities and you end up with the whole country under emergency, and that Morsi seems to be a little bit too quick on the trigger and too eager to use his vast presidential powers.
What, where do you think this is going? In other words, the people who started the revolution are again in the streets protesting. The Muslim Brotherhood has the votes, and if you're correct, probably will continue to have votes for a while. I don't know if a lot of people thought that Arab Spring was going to be kind of like a walk in the park, but it's released all these conflicting forces. Where do you think it's going from here?
Well, I think that the left and the labor and the liberals, the people who are unhappy with Muslim Brotherhood rule, are just going to have to get their act together and learn how to contest elections. There's not any evidence that Morsi won, in any dirty way in June. It seems to have been an above-board election, and the judges did oversee it. So it's not clear that the Brotherhood, you know, wants to come to power illicitly. It just happens to be good at winning those elections. And these people who, you know, like street politics and think that they can influence things by coming out and demonstrating, are putting their energies, it seems to me, in the wrong place, because it's highly unlikely that they can get their way by demonstrating now. And that the way that they would have an influence going forward would be to be in parliament. And almost none of them were. Almost none of the young people who made the revolution got elected to parliament. There were a couple of them.
So they feel left out then of they feel left out of the whole process. But instead of adjusting to where Egypt is moving, they're returning to what they did 2 years ago that was so effective. Is that what
you're... Well, they've been doing it all along. There have been lots of demonstrations. I mean, they kept insisting that a sovereignty should be invested in parliament, that there should be popular sovereignty, which is, you know, the basic Enlightenment principle of modern governance. And so the last 2 years, mostly what the left and the liberals did was to protest continued military dominance. And they got an elected president, and the military does seem to have been demoted a bit. So now they're protesting the president. And it just seems to me that that if they're going to win in this new situation, they have to stand by their commitment to parliamentary government. This is what they say they want, and make with their activities. And the youth, the activist youth, don't want to form political parties. They see them as old hat. They believe in networking. They want to put up a Facebook group. They want to have a flash mob. They want to have demonstrations. And I don't see that those tactics as viable as a way of governing a country. I mean, they can be very useful in a social movement and in overturning a government or whatever. But if what you need now is a parliament that would, you know, make laws and move the country forward, handle the economy and so forth. And
parties over time to get to work.
That's not what's happening.
Yeah, parties over time to get to work. What is the U.S.'s role here? Is there a U.S. role? You know, we're watching everything going on. The opposition, such as it is not organized and then wants to, like I say, play a social media role rather than an effective political role. There have been changes, and certainly from the Mubarak era. What does the U.S. do?
Well, I don't think the U.S. is very relevant to what's happening in Egypt. I know that, you know, the U.S. is an imperial power in the world, and it throws its weight around quite a lot, and in some instances it intervenes and so forth. But I think, first of all, the Mubarak government that was overthrown was seen as a key U.S. asset. I don't think anybody in Washington was happy to see it go. But in the end, the Obama administration decided that you couldn't stand against, you know, a million people in Tahrir Square, that Mubarak's days were just up, and you had to adjust to the situation. I see Obama as somewhat of a realist, a little bit in the Bush senior mold. And so, you know, the realists are all about reality-based politics and foreign policy. So I think the U.S. has just gone along with what has happened, and I can't imagine anybody in Washington is very happy with how things have turned out. But they're seeing if they can work with the new situation. So they've done diplomacy with Mohamed Morsi, a Muslim Brotherhood figure who's been very, in the past, fiery anti-American, anti-Israel, said anti-Semitic things. But Morsi says, you know, he doesn't want to see the peace with Israel overturned. He is willing to take U.S. aid and actually from a Washington point of view, one of the advantages of Morsi is that the Muslim Brotherhood is economically right wing. They're all for entrepreneurial activity and a free market, and they're kind of neoliberals. So Washington likes that aspect of the Brotherhood rule, but I just don't see any evidence or any sign that the U.S. Is intervening or is really capable of intervening in Egypt. I think everybody involved in Egyptian politics is riding a tiger right now.
What do you think the implications are for Egypt's relationship with Israel?
Well, Egypt's relationship with Israel is going to be chillier. Morsi came up through the ranks in anti-Zionist organizations in the Muslim Brotherhood and in the provinces of Egypt. He has a strong relationship with Hamas, which is, in a way, a kind of maverick branch of the Muslim Brotherhood and dominates the Gaza Strip, one of the two Palestinian territories occupied by the Israelis. The Israelis view Hamas as a dire enemy. Morsi kind of sees them as friends. That's not promising for the future. The Israelis have Gaza under a blockade. They don't let the Gazans export most of what they make. This is illegal in international law, but Morsi objects to it, just as Turkey objects to it, and indeed, I think most of the European Union objects to it. So Morsi is not going to be a compliant pro-Israeli figure of the sort that that Mubarak basically was. I mean, Mubarak would sometimes criticize Israel, but you always knew in Washington if you called him Mubarak and say, do X, he would do it. That's not true of Morsi. And so I think there will be chillier relations. I don't expect hostile relations. I think they'll be just move towards neutral.
Right.
And they would have to go back on... I think most people know that that Israel gets a huge portion of our foreign aid, so-called foreign aid, because it's a lot of its military, and that Egypt gets the second, I guess, largest, or at least it used to get the second largest, a lot because it made peace with Israel. So Egypt has an economic interest in not starting any kind of open conflict. But why haven't they done more to help the situation in Gaza, to open the border, the Egyptian border with Gaza? And are they really as happy with the Hamas as they might be? Are they? Is there some conflict there?
Well, the Egyptians are in a tough spot with regard to Gaza. I mean, they really don't like the blockade on the Gaza Strip that the Israelis have imposed. But, you know, if they just open up the Rafah crossing into the Sinai Peninsula into Egypt, there's danger of Israeli intervention. The Israelis have been known to bomb Gaza because they thought there's things coming into Gaza that, you know, rockets or whatever that might harm Israel. The Israelis might just bomb the crossing, and the Egyptians really wouldn't be able to do anything about that. So you don't want to put yourself in a position where you adopt a policy that gets shot down. And then the other thing is the Egyptians, I think, are afraid that it's possible that the Israelis, in one of their attacks on Gaza, and they've attacked it twice in recent years, could cause a panic. And if the border were completely open, the 1.7 million Gazans might just flee as refugees into Sinai, which is a desert, and there's no way to deal with that situation. And it's not what the Egyptians want. They want the Israelis to accept a Palestinian state. They don't want the Palestinians to end up as refugees in Egypt. So I think there are a lot of, you know, realpolitik reasons for which the Egyptians can't just throw open the checkpoint. But certainly they're letting in more medicine. And, you know, the Israelis had put a two-way blockade. One, they didn't let the Palestinians export most of what they make. But they also had severely limited what could go into Gaza. One Israeli official said they were going to put the Palestinians in Gaza on a diet. And that limitation on what goes in has been moderated a bit, but it's still quite draconian. And the Egyptians have played a role in letting more staples and medicine and so forth in.
We just have a little less than a minute or so left. Are you optimistic? Is that what we should ask, Mike? Are you optimistic about what's happening in Egypt? Is this going to eventually lead into a very Egyptian version of a parliamentary democracy? Are they going to be able to get their economy going? We've just got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, I think the game is open. It's parliamentary politics. They'll have elections. People will lose and win. Welcome to democracy.
It's not. What would you say? Democracy is always messy, right, Mike?
Yeah, that's what everybody says. Ours was pretty messy. We tend to forget that.
We do forget that. Juan Cole's blog is Informed Comment. It's one of the most important blogs on the internet. Lots of different opinions there. Lots of different things.
This podcast, the show, will be on vvid.org, as are all our others. Vvid.org. You can listen to the show in a day or two by the time we get it up there.
And Juan Cole's latest book is, what is that called? It's 2009. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.